sing the Star Spangled Banner. It's red, white, and blue. It's the American way. It's the American me. It's the American you.
It is the American way. It is the American way. It is the American way. It is the American way.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathurst Pierre's Broadsides, the January 13th, 2005 edition, with special guests from Clearview Court and renegades from the SEIU lurking in the studio. Stay with us.
Living in the city, it's a hard thing to do. Spending time here makes me so sad and blue. My heart is in the mountains, it's where I wanna be. So mountain lady, where are you? I need you next to me. Kind very few times, you know it feels good to see a lady with peace in her heart. It's like I knew she would. Her hair was long, soft and cool. Her eyes were sparkling blue. Reminds me of meadows in the summertime, with flowers, crystal clear water, and a soft warm breeze blowing too. It's a hard thing to do. Spending time here makes me so sad and blue. My heart is in the mountains, it's where I want to be. So mountain lady, where are you? I need you next to me. So mountain lady, where are you? I need you next to me.
That was Downtown Dave, one of our own musicians, off of his own disc. I tell you what song it was, but I can't be sure until I remove the disc from the machine, and I'm not going to do that right now. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, and you're listening to a two-hour show concerned with civil rights and civil wrongs in Santa Cruz. In the studio with me, I have three live guests. I'm going to introduce them one after another. First, we have, let's start with Penny Oliver. Hey, Penny, say hello. Hey, and what, how would you describe yourself? Are you a community activist, interested resident? Okay, of Clearview Court. Okay, and that's the mobile home park that had rent control gutted by the city council last year and is now facing further devastation through the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel project. Also, we have with us Liberty Lana. Hey, Liberty.
Hi.
And just what is your claim to fame? Who are you? And why should we even listen to you? Hold it. I realize your mic was not up. I'd like to apologize to everybody. That was Penny who was trying to talk. You probably heard her distantly in the background as a tiny voice. Penny is a resident of Clearview Court. Say hello again, Penny. I'm sorry.
Sorry, hello again.
Sorry about that, folks. Go ahead, Liberty.
Okay, my name is Liberty. I'm leaving Clearview Court.
I'm still having problems. That mic may not be connected. Let me see here. Let me double check.
Where is it?
Turn it on.
Hello? Okay, it's going now?
Now it's going. It's good.
Okay. My name is Liberty Lana, and I live in Clearview Court, who we are fighting with the city. Maybe fighting is not the right thing to say, but we're complaining, especially in my case, I complain about the garage is going to be building about 15 feet from my house, bedroom window.
That's the $30 million boondoggle garage that the taxpayers get to support on the Rotkin Council's development.
And one of the things that really bothers me is that they never talked to us about that. They, yes, did it. They did all the plans, and they put it to the public, not to the public, all the council members. And then we knew through the newspapers. So I'm against that, and I will fight it.
And we're going to hear more about that. I want to hear more about that. In fact, you know, keep those remarks in mind. Let's hear the third guest we have is Tim Ahern, who's SEIU what? What are you, anyway?
415. I'm the home care chapter president. I serve as the chair of the education committee and also on the executive board.
And your SEIU has voted in favor of the Coast Hotel?
No, at this point, the CLC, the Central, the Labor Council, has recommended that we endorse the project. The project went to the COPE committee, which stands for the Committee on Political Education. That committee did vote to recommend to the executive board to endorse the project.
Okay, and now let's clarify for folks. We're going to be talking about what this project is for those of you who just tuned in and don't know. We're talking about a multi-million dollar hotel destruction and rebuilding for a so-called Better Convention Center. At the moment, I'm an opponent of the project, and my bias will probably enter into this discussion. However, that is not going to prevent me from letting those who favor the project, and if you'd like to call in, let me tell you how to do that. You just make a phone call very simply to 427-3772 if you can. We only have one line into the studio, unfortunately, so if somebody else is on the line, or if I screw up and don't push the right buttons, it's going to sound like somebody is. But hopefully that won't happen. 427-3772. You can also jump on your, if you've got a computer, the Internet, if you have access to it. And you can go to www.pagesincolor.com, www.pagesincolor.com, and you can ask your questions on that website. And I will try to find it every so often and see if we actually can tune in on what's going on. There it is, pagesincolor.com. It looks like I'm having a little trouble reaching the Pages in Color, but we'll shortly. Maybe I won't reach it shortly. In any case, do stay tuned. If you have a comment, you can either get through to us at Pages in Color or 427-3772. Dial the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, also my phone. Leave a message there, and I will try to pass on your comments. Probably not this show, but in fact, surely not this show. But then I do another show on Sunday, a longer show, and we'll be continuing this issue. Since the issue is coming up at City Council in a week, there'll be two special council meetings. One of them will be on Tuesday at 7 o'clock at the usual place at the City Council Chambers downtown. The other will be across the street the next day, also at 7 o'clock, at the Civic Auditorium on the 19th. I think I'm right about that, folks. I'm going to make sure we got... Now, the way we're going to begin this discussion is I am looking at Indy Media, which is the local independent media news service, which I often post articles on, and also others do as well. There is an article about the City Council makes move to redevelop Dream Inn to five-story convention center. Make your voice heard January 20th. Now, this is I think it's an opponent of the convention center who's writing this article. I'm going to read his arguments, then I'm going to read the arguments of a proponent, and then I'm going to let the guests here rip with their own thoughts and reflections on this issue. Here's the statement by the opponent, which leads off the article. The opponent's name is, for those who are interested, Jack Shit. Now, this is a pseudonym. I don't know who he is, but or who she is, but this is what this person writes about the story, about the situation coming up. Within Santa Cruz County, there is an entirely entity separate from the city, yet still directly connected to it. This entity is the redevelopment agency. The purpose of the redevelopment agency is to, separately from the city, improve blighted areas, not to blight improved areas. Yet it has just this in mind. In a sneaky deal between the redevelopment agency and the Coast Hotel, plans have been devised to demolish the current hotel, the Dream Inn, and its parking lot, and replace it with a five-story convention center and gigantic matching parking structure. Because of its controversy, the city has been planning it in secrecy for about 2 years, and information about it has just been released to the public. Aside from incredibly biased photographs portraying the plans blocking Cowell's Beach from public access, included in the package is a payoff to the redevelopment agency alone. No direct revenues paid to the city, yet at the same time, the city will be forced to pay for the construction. The public hearing on the redevelopment of the Coast Hotel is 7 p.m. Tuesday, January 18th, as I mentioned before, in City Council Chambers, 809 Center Street, and again the next day, 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 19th, in the Civic Auditorium, 307 Church Street. The economics of this plan have been questioned by many people, including experts, and have not been validated by anyone, including increased noise and traffic pollution. This project will affect the daily lives of many of the citizens of Santa Cruz directly and block access to the beautiful West Coast, West Cliff Drive for over 2 years. During the creation of the plans, not even city council members had their questions answered by developers. In fact, this plan may well sweep by almost invisibly under the supervision of the city council without the residents of Santa Cruz voicing their resistance. On January 18th and 19th, a member of the city council estimated that at least 400 people showing up to this public hearing is necessary to prevent the city council from giving the redevelopment agency and the Coast Hotel from going through with these plans that will not benefit anyone except a select few. The city must be honest about its actions. And now I'm trying to draw up another story. Here's another story of it. The council should be crawling all over ourselves, begging to make this project work, said Santa Cruz City Councilman Mike Rotkin. As a city council, Santa Cruz City Council members crawled all over themselves in support of a proposal by the owners of the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel, formerly the Dream Inn, for a significant expansion. The existing hotel sits on top of the public beach adjacent to West Cliff Drive. The proposal is to knock down the existing hotel with 163 rooms and replace it with a new 268-room facility. The Santa Cruz City Council, not willing to allow nature to stand in the way of fun, voted 7-0 to override their own planning commission to approve on the 150-foot-tall thrill ride, otherwise known as the double shot. Actually, they're talking about a number of... This is the California Coast Watcher newsletter, so I'm going to skip that particular section. That's the opponents of the plan. Now, here is a response from a guy who calls himself Robert S. We have rather colorful names on the indie media by those who don't like to identify themselves. I actually posted something where I actually identified, said who I was, But that's neither here nor there. I hope those that have written about the hotel conference center before me will allow me to correct a few of the errors in their comments about the hotel project. This so-called secret project has been discussed many times at open public meetings by the city council. One of the earliest of those meetings took place in November 2003. It was reported in the Sentinel at that time 15 months ago. Here's a link to that story. Okay, so maybe info in the Sentinel doesn't count. Check Indy Media's own article from about 10 months ago revealing the plan. Here's the page, gives the website. Additionally, detailed information has been available on the city's website for several months, including both draft and final environmental impact report. So it really hasn't been a secret. What about this claim? The economics of this plan have been questioned by many people, including experts, and have not been validated by anyone. The fact is that several independent experts have been hired to examine the finances of this project and have said that they work well for the city, increasing revenue to both the city's redevelopment agency and the city's general fund. Just because Jack hasn't bothered to find these reports is no reason for him to claim they don't exist. Jack also wrote alarmingly about the plans blocking Cowles Beach from public access. This is simply another mistake on Jack's part. The hotel project will increase public access because they will build a new stairway from Westcliff at Bay down to Cowell Beach. This will provide access where none exists now. In all their respects, the access is the same as it is now. So it is a net gain in access at no cost to the taxpayers. Jack also wrote, during the creation of the plans, not even city council members had their questions answered by developers. There is simply no basis in reality for this claim. The hotel owners have been meeting with individual city council members and the whole council over many months. That sounds a little evasive to me. Did they answer to that city council meeting would be my question. But finally, Jack wrote, the city must be honest about its actions. The city seems to be open and honest about the plans based on how easy it has been for me to find out so much. I hope Jack will hold himself to the same standard as he expects from the city. Then there were two other comments. One was by Becky Johnson, who again opposes the project. Geez, why would anyone who lives here want to subsidize a for-profit private property owner with $30 million of public funds, because on paper, anyway, we will break even sometime in the next century. The contractors, plumbers, electricians, and unions are in favor of it because of the lucrative jobs it will bring them. But seriously, if you're a taxpayer, this ripoff should piss you off. I mean the audacity of it. And notice, they always promise how many union jobs will come to our community out of this, but even that is not guaranteed. They could be just another set of low-paying jobs well below a living wage. And don't forget how much fun a lot more traffic will bring to our quality of life. The supporter of the project says, on Becky Johnson's comment about the city's $30 million subsidy, just so everyone knows, the part of the project the city will pay for will be owned by the city. The city will make money from the ownership. And on the labor question, the hotel is already unionized and will continue to be until the workers there decide otherwise. The project is a legally binding commitment to pay construction workers a union wage with benefits. By the way, did anyone mention that this project includes knocking down what is arguably the ugliest building in Santa Cruz and a building that is close to zero wheelchair access? The new building will be shorter, have first-class wheelchair access, and be built to green building certification standards. Jack really ought to take a closer look at the piece of shit that is now there before he spends any more energy defending it. The reason I read this whole article from Indy Media, and just go on the website, Santa Cruz Indy Media, if you want to look it over, is because we have in the studio four, including myself, critics of this plan. So it seems only fair that we should also have some person describing support for the plan. But let's give the critics a chance to rail, since the city council pretty much has got this one down. And a lot of us think it's a done deal. Who wants to start on this? Liberty, I want to lead off and give a punch to the chops here.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a done deal. I think what was happened to us in Clearview Court last year, that we lost with rent control, that was in the plan of the city council members to get ready of the rent control in Clearview Court. So they were free of us to start doing the other project. So even that sometimes during that year, we were thinking, why the city council members don't look for another avenue to fight for us? Because this is a low-income housing. We didn't understand why even Ed Porter was asking the other members of the city council looking for money, because he knew there wasn't money for us someplace. And especially Kennedy, Scott Kennedy, we knew that he was, no, we want to get these people out of the city.
Well, of course, Kennedy is gone. Porter actually surprisingly won again, although Porter did not vote for you in the final vote on Clearview Court, right?
I don't remember.
My recollection is that there was a 7-0 support for this sellout of rent control.
But at least he was trying to convince the other people in the beginning of all the talking to do something. And we asking ourselves, why? They didn't look for something that we can help us. Now we know.
It would be nice if he kept the principled stand and voted in the end what he began to say in the beginning.
Yeah,
incautious souls might think he had changed his mind and suddenly believed what the rest of the council thought is that mainly it's not important to have rent control, even though they promised it to you way back in 92, 93,
yes,
right?
Yes.
In perpetuity.
Along with
the ANZA motorhome, mobile home park rent.
So my guess is they knew what was coming in, and we didn't share with the city. So they were discussing among themselves. And then in the last moment, everything is rushing to build that hotel.
For those who don't know, Clearview Court is right across the street from the Dream Inn, right?
Yes,
and
that's
what
it is.
How many people live there?
64 families. 64?
66?
66 families. 66 families. And each family is families with children, with young children, young couples, people retire like myself and my friend. So it's all like a little community that is part of Santa Cruz. And one of the things really bothers me is the city council, they don't even think that we are there. I don't think it's in their mind. For them, we are not there because they don't care about us. They never talk about us directly. And one of the things that I want to say before I forgot, really bothers me that they talk about the trees. It's like in this project.
Emily Riley is big on the
those
trees.
Those trees are so important. They're important for me. I love trees.
You're
I don't
about
want
the trees at Clearview Court.
No, the trees in the park lot.
The Dream Inn.
Yeah, all these big Redwood heritage trees.
Oh, the heritage trees, yes. Mm-hmm.
But they never talk about the kids that they are going to be in the shadow of these seven
trees. Kids can be replaced. Babies are replaced.
They're growing up and they leave, right?
You know, I mean,
and the young families and people like myself that I'm old and I'm going to be in the shadow of these big 6-7 floors, I don't know.
And that's one of the issues that Clearview Court has been talking about, which is namely that you're going to be shadowed out by the overtowering structure.
Oh, yes.
And what's the significance? I mean, what people would say, well, you still got a great place near the beach. It's a prime property. You may not have rent control anymore. Actually, what is the situation with rent control? Rent control has been eliminated as far as you're being able to mm-hmm. pass it on to other people. Do you still have it until you transfer the property?
Yeah, we have 34 years. If I live there for 34 years,
okay.
Still I'm in some type of rent control. Some type.
Now, does that mean the rent goes up by the cost of living each
yeah.
year?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought that it was going to increase in advance of the cost of living. I thought that there was some concern. I know Anita Webb, who's your vice president of the Clearview mm-hmm. Court, your association, was fighting desperately to, you know, maintain to keep in check the rapacious appetites, I guess, of the owners who want to raise the rents big time and wasn't really able to succeed very much. And where is that at now? Penny can tell us. Penny, go ahead. Penny, all
Anita
over.
Webb and the rest of the people who worked on it, the situation did improve.
Okay.
It wasn't resolved totally satisfactorily, but it did improve. And Ed Porter did put in energy to try to help it improve. The rent control was still taken away, but the terms were considerably better by the end of the entire negotiation slash altercation
uh-huh.
than they were in the beginning.
And what are those terms generally? The rent goes up. I know at the
end. Upon the sale
yeah.
of a. If a person is under rent control and they sell it, the new buyer is not under rent control. There's a tier of prices related to the size of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not on rent control, you go immediately into that tier structure.
Two or three or four times as much as the current rent? Or what's your
depends
rent?
On the size. The smallest houses, i.e., around 500 or less.
Mm-hmm. 500 square feet? Or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are only affected a little more than $100 a month. The larger houses can be affected up to $1,000 a month. So,
and practically speaking, how is that going to impact the ability of people to sell their coaches?
It makes it more difficult, but it's not the only thing that makes it more difficult. All this uncertainty and the parking garage looming.
You have a beautiful Dream Inn being replaced by a Santa Cruz Coast Hotel. What could be finer?
It's going to be a lot larger. It's going to be a lot more traffic, a lot more fumes, and all the shade from the garage that's at present just an open parking lot.
But couldn't members of, I mean, aren't people actually being given an opportunity to go out, for example, as people in third world countries are, and sell Chiclets to the tourists who are coming into the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel? I mean, you could, a whole new cottage industry could happen there.
Well, I understand, folks, your sarcasm,
yes,
but
yes,
no. Yeah. As long as I have this thing,
go for it.
My principal concern is the increased traffic, mm-hmm, the hugeness of the garage, actually even just its presence, and the resultant fumes that come from cars idling along right behind our houses as they wait to go through the money accepting machine, you know, when you get your ticket and mm-hmm pay your fees
for the parking lot,
and the lines of cars that will develop behind the traffic lights, and the fumes from the entire parking garage, since the Westcliff Drive side is solid and the Bay Street side is solid, have to come out into the mobile home park. They have no other place to go. One of the plans even suggested putting large fans on each level to blow the fumes out into our yards.
Well, it's a form of population control, you see.
It's a way of getting rid of us so they can do what they want.
Yeah, but think of it this way. The city will eventually benefit, and we'll all remember you with fond regards.
Have a nice time.
Yeah. You know, Penny, let me ask you a couple more questions about this. The Dream Inn, what is the current situation with the Dream Inn? Do you have a traffic and exhaust problem currently with the hotel across the street? How does it stack up right now?
The traffic gets pretty intense along Westcliff Drive, particularly on especially nice days or days with big waves. The traffic is backed up for blocks along Westcliff Drive as is. Or when people are going to work or coming home from work at those parts of the day. So it's already a problem.
Now, what about the number of people that will be using this structure? How many people use the Dream Inn currently? What's the nature of the expansion? I think you may have already mentioned it, but do you know?
No, I don't understand exactly what you're asking.
How many more rooms are going to be there?
It's a little over 100. But at present, okay, curiously, for perhaps 8 months out of the year, the Dream Inn is not very occupied. At least its parking lot is almost entirely empty for way over half of the year. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that this convention center is a magic cure.
You think that that'll be the same problem for the convention center?
I would expect. Monterey's is seemingly having that same problem. Seagate and Chaminade don't seem to be jam-packed all the time just because they exist. I don't think that this one will either. And since the city's not supposed to benefit financially for 30 years, I don't really see why the people who are behind it are so adamantly behind it unless they just want a monument to themselves.
What about the argument that the redevelopment agency is getting a payoff in a certain sense?
That could well be.
Because I've got no stats on this. Why don't we ask Tim here, our union man, what he thinks about this. I mean, this is going to provide some fine jobs for your union sisters and brothers. What's your problem,
Tim? Well, not only fine jobs, but we have jobs here that have been guaranteed health benefits, that the employer is going to guarantee them. I find that a little bit hard to believe.
Why would that be hard to believe?
in this time of healthcare where it's so difficult and it's disappearing so quickly, it's difficult.
And that's, of course,
to believe
a major
this
issue for the upcoming Albertsons strike, I
it
guess.
It absolutely is. Some of the figures I have about some of the stuff we've talked about, the heritage trees, for instance, there's a total of 25 trees that are currently there. 10 of them are going to stay. They're going to actually relocate 10 of the trees. And I understand, right, and I understand they're moving them to a really nice vacation spot where they have their own concierge and people
really?
To take care of them, which is really nice.
Saunas.
Right, saunas and hot towel treatments. And then 5 of them will be removed. But the garage, as you said, that goes up will be a 50-foot garage that will provide 24-hour shade. For the areas that are affected, and anyone who has any kind of environmental knowledge or sensitivity.
Great for those hot summer days. I mean, what's the complaint here?
This is yet another attempt to get rid of the poor or the people that are not wealthy enough to live in a large home in Santa Cruz.
I know that the city council currently. Sounds like a lot of people here feel it's a done deal, and I guess there was an item on the city council agenda this. 2 days ago on something about giving more money to consultants or more money to staff to process complaints and comments around the environmental impact report for this. I was going to go to City Council. Did anybody see the afternoon City Council meeting on Tuesday or know anything about this?
I haven't seen that. I do know that this still has to get past the Coastal Commission, and that's a pretty major hurdle in getting the project to go forward. And
last night the traffic people voted against it, all excepting one person. I don't know if it was 6-1 against or 7-1 against, but...
How long was it discussed at the commission, do you know? How many hours?
At the traffic? A number of hours. I don't know how long.
Was there... Sorry?
I left at 10 o'clock, and it's still there.
Started at 7. Was most of the testimony against the hotel?
Oh. Yeah, all the testimonies. I was there till the last person went to talk, and then I left before the vote. But everybody was a neighbor, and except the two first ones, what they talk, how pleased they were about the bicycles, that they put this sign for the bicycles. But all the neighbors in Lighthouse Avenue and all that area, they were against, and they say it.
Did any city council members attend the meeting? Or?
Yeah, Ed Porter was there.
He was the only one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Penny, you have something you wanted to say? Tim?
Sure. Back in 1998, the beach south of Laurel Plan was adopted, as we all know and love. The idea was for the convention center to be built down on Beach Street, which was to bring year-round traffic. Somehow that got changed. That's the Baha'i now?
Right. Well, of course, there was a whole city council election fighting the residents down there didn't like the idea. They thought it was going to displace the Latina community. And what happened there, of course, was they built the Dolphin Lee Nueva Vista project which they didn't build the hotel project, and they didn't realign Third Street, but it's set up to do the Third Street realignment. But an election was run on that, and actually three new candidates won. Mm-hmm. We thought they were going to be progressive. At least some of us did.
I guess my question is, what is the difference between Clearview Court and the flat? The people who are living there in beach flats.
Probably the people in the beach flats were better organized and they had more support to fight it.
Well,
for example, in Capitola, this is something I mentioned in the last show. Capitola has, of course, many mobile home parks, many trailer parks. And they actually, the city assesses people in these parks, I think at $6 a month now, and they're going to try to raise it to $20 a month to fight legally to keep rent control, because they have rent control in Capitola for parks, unlike in socialist feminist mayor-run Santa Cruz, where we have Mayor Rotkin, who helped destroy rent control for trailer parks, and in old capitalist Capitola, as some call Capitola, they have an enlightened rent control policy, because, of course, there's so many people inside mobile homes, because there's such a large constituency that they don't dare to act otherwise. But they did state, and apparently a piece of literature recently, according to a secondhand report I heard from a woman who lives in a trailer in Capitola, that one of the concerns they had is that at De Anza, the mobile homes sold for less than $5,000 recently, 4 of them. So that's a considerable drop in value. How much, for example, do you think an average Clearview Court person paid for their mobile home? $100,000. So that's the, so you'll get 5% of what you put in.
From 60 to
250. So you'll at least get what? 1/10 of what you put into it. So there's no really no need to complain about this.
Yeah, but when we sell that houses, we have to give in equity. We have to give to the owners 70%.
If there's any profit,
they get the 70%, and we get the 30%.
You won't have any profit.
No.
So, in fact, you'll have a major loss. You can take a tax deduction, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm being sarcastic, folks. This is a disgrace, and it's a destruction of low-income housing, and I've been raging about it for a year and a half. But the only person on the city council who seemed to have any concerns about it was Ed Porter. And as I said before, Ed collapsed and went on Clearview Court. On De Anza, he was stronger. On Clearview Court, apparently, he helped to work to deal with some of the issues. But in the end, he voted to destroy rent control. He did not vote in favor of retaining rent control. But not sufficiently to keep rent control in place, right? But it's not gone in places like Capitola, which is kind of strange. Whereas in liberal Santa Cruz, apparently liberal Santa Cruz, it's gone. Tony Madrigal is a new city council member. Tim, you're familiar with Tony because he's been involved in the union work you've been involved in, right?
That's right. He is the representative for the SEIU for the home care chapter.
And how's he been doing in terms... I mean, well, I guess we should...
Tony is not necessarily the number one proponent within the union for the project. Leslie Scanagata, who represents the city of Santa Cruz, was the person at the COPE meeting who spearheaded the pro hotel.
Let's take this call, please. Because we always respond to our callers. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Tim, Penny, and Liberty, and Robert.
Hello. Hey, Robert, this is Scott.
Hey, Scott, what's the word?
Well, I was just at a meeting out at Gordon Pusser's house with Mike Rockin. There's this group, Scrap, that Santa Cruz for some sort of... good planning. I forgot what the initials actually stand for right now, but it escapes me. But anyway, basically the meeting was about the Coast Hotel and their plans on what to do and all that. And Rockin, you know, went on and on and on about the economic benefits to the city. And, you know, he was citing that because they're going to be adding more rooms to the hotel, that the hotel is going to be generating an extra $500,000 to go into the city's general fund. And then a number of people at the meeting were pointing out that, well, because of this $30 million contribution by the city, if the rosiest, you know, predictions of how much revenue is going to be generated don't come true, the actual paying back of this $30 million, because the redevelopment agency is going to be putting in the $30 million. They're going to float a loan or put out bonds or whatever, and then pay that back through the tax increment. And Mike was, you know, touting the tax increment, you know, the amount of money that will be generated because of, you know, the tax is going, well, the tax increment's going to all be eaten up by this $30 million loan.
Can you clarify that for those who don't know what that means?
Well, the tax increment is in a redevelopment zone, which the Coast Hotel is part of, part of the Beach South of Laurel redevelopment area. Once a property has been approved, the difference in the taxes on that property from what it originally was before improvement, and then the difference of what the tax rate is on that property, the property tax rate is on the property after improvements, all that difference, which they call a tax increment, all go to the redevelopment agency. That's how the redevelopment agency funds itself. And so if the redevelopment agency ponies up $30 million to build the parking structure and the conference center part of this hotel, it's going to take all that tax increment for approximately 30 years.
This sounds a little like...
pay off this $30 million.
Scott, this sounds a little like taking all the money in the Dolphin Lee Nueva Vista project for all the affordable housing for 15 years.
Right, yeah. It's basically the same sort of scenario where they're, you know, even though the city's... So basically, the city's going to be building a parking lot for this place and building a conference center for them, both of which they will run. So the city won't really make any money off of that. And so it's questionable, why would the city invest this $30 million? If the hotel thought that the conference center part of the deal was a good enough investment, wouldn't they put that money in instead of the city? And, you know, why would the city want to tie, you know, if the city's not doesn't invest the $30 million, will the project go away? And Rockin's response to that was, no, but the conference center part of it will. Well, the conference center isn't necessarily going to be what generates all this tax revenue. It's the hotel occupancy tax. So,
well, that actually was pointed out that occupancy tax, I guess they're looking for a 4% increase in the transient occupancy tax.
Well, what it is the hotel has promised the city that they would put a 4% surcharge above and beyond the current occupancy tax on the hotel for X number of years. I'm not sure if that was 10 or 15 years.
And doesn't that make it likely, Scott, that there will be no further TOT assessments by the city council, which has in the past tried to use those assessments to support low-income housing and homeless services? Or am I wrong about that?
Well, the last time that it was on the ballot, it was actually to fund the CVC, the Visitors Council, which is basically just the advertising arm of the boardwalk, which currently gets funded out of the general fund. And I personally think that, you know, their own statistics say, well, for every dollar that you spend on the CVC, $70 gets spent in Santa Cruz. Well, if that's true, then why aren't all the businesses, the hotels, and the boardwalk picking up the tab for the CVC? Why is the community as a whole?
Let me get some comments from the guests on anything you've said. Any reaction to this, Tim? You're looking at some.
Well,
some
I'm
notes
looking or... at some numbers that we have. They're estimating a revenue of about $2.7 million per year coming back, if in the best case scenario.
Well, yeah, but $2.2 million will service the debt on the $30 million.
That is correct. So it would take up to about 40 years to pay for this project before we see a return.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you this, Scott, because you were at this meeting with Rodkin. Were any other city council heavies there?
No.
Well, Rodkin is pretty much a heavy. Why was he showing up? If this is a done deal, why is Rodkin bothering to show up at Gordon Pusser's for this discussion?
Well, I mean... You know, they have invited other council members to come to other meetings, and this was just his turn to show up.
So, in other words, it's just a pro forma.
And he was doing his usual soft shoe, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know, if there's, you know, overrouting concerns and all this stuff, if they don't get fixed, you know, this will never happen, and da-da-da-da-da.
Well, let me ask you this, Scott. I mean, there's a sort of a gloomy feeling among, at least Liberty expressed it, that this is a done deal and there's not much we can do. And I guess there was a statement on the Indy Media that you'd need 400 people to come to the Civic Auditorium next Wednesday in order to turn back the city council. What's your reading on what's needed to stop this project, or at least delay it till it could be more, you know, carefully examined?
Well, you know, the hotel industry, the CVC, and the boardwalk are going to make all of their employees show up and talk in favor of it. So you're talking, you know, this will be like the Beach South of Laurel hearings, where you're going to have anywhere from 300 to 500 people there. They're going to be in favor of it. So unless there's, you know, at least the same amount, but it would be better if there's actually more people against it that are willing to come up and talk, you know, because if you're just there in the audience, you don't get counted. But if you actually go up in front of them and say, hey, slow this process down, let's do something, you know, that's good for everybody, not just good for the hotel owners, whatever. But people are going to have to show up in mass and talk, because they're, unless they, the council can feel the heat from the community, they're just going to go ahead with this.
You know, I'm afraid you're right. Any comments from the Peanut Gallery here?
Well, I know the city is responsible for the convention center itself, with an agreement by the hotel people to lease it. If they don't follow that agreement, the city will be responsible for the convention center and having
to
fill it.
Well, that's another problem. Convention centers nationwide have ended up being massive anchors around the necks of communities that have decided to build them. You know, if a private concern comes in and builds one, that's a different story. But if public money goes into the building of a place, and then public money is needed to sustain it because, say, the hotel owners aren't making money off it, so they just decide, oh, we don't, you know, we're not going to run it anymore. You can have it back. It could end up being a major expense.
Does that happen in other cities, you know?
Yeah, it happened all over the country. It happened in San Jose.
Okay. Well,
that's
Penny's,
the nearest place it happened.
Penny's got a comment. Go ahead, Penny.
Well, this is just an aside, but if the benefit is supposed for the city is supposed to be financial, why did they turn over the Holiday Inn to the university, thereby foregoing what I've been told is $500,000 a year room tax that used to be generated by tourists?
No, they did not turn it over to the university.
They rent it to students.
I know, but the university made their own deal with the Holiday Inn. The city had nothing. The city actually opposed that for that very reason, because it was $500,000 to $700,000 in hotel tax every year.
Let me ask all of you a question. You too, Scott. Why should homeless and... Are you still there? Hello? I think we may have lost him. I guess this show is often concerned with police abuse, civil rights for poor and homeless people. How does this impact homeless and poor people? I mean, it certainly impacts the neighbors. It impacts people in Clearview Court, because you're seeing your property, essentially, your futures are kind of being, you know, dickered away here. It affects, let me ask you that question, Tim, or you know, Liberty, you could answer it too.
Well, there's a lot of effects. I mean, the zoning is definitely one of the largest effects. I mean, they're asking the zoning to be changed from a current 36-foot, like three stories, going to 77 feet, which is seven stories. Essentially changing that zoning will make it so that anyone can build along and put up buildings which are that size.
But how's that going to affect poor people? Why should they care what size the buildings are?
Once again, by bringing in that kind of upper-scale traffic, what we're going to do is push out the people who are living here, who are trying to make a life here, not necessarily looking at their lives in terms of profit as being dollars and cents, but in terms of profit as being quality of life issues, things of that nature. And I think that's where often the union and people that are representing the workers, this is where it breaks down. When they look at the project as a pure dollars and cents profit, the quote from Leslie in the COPE meeting was, "We are unionists, not environmentalists, not politicians," but essentially negating the fact that profit can't be measured in just dollars. And in this case, that's what we're looking at. Someone who's trying to say this is going to be hugely beneficial in dollars, but not looking at what the other impacts are.
We were talking before this caller came up. Liberty, do you want to say something about this? No. We were talking before this caller called in about Tony Madrigal, who's a new council member. Many people view him as kind of a bright light. He's a Latino. He speaks Spanish. He's led concerns about rental abuses in the beach flats. I've been critical of him on a number of grounds as well. But what's your perspective on Tony, Tim, and how he's been acting in terms of... He's a union, he's a paid union rep, right?
He's a paid union rep. He's paid very well. There's a great great program there. Their contract is terrific, very far-reaching. If they make vacation reservations and for some reason can't go on vacation, the union will pay for those reservations. They've got a great contract, whereas some of us don't even have health insurance. Actually, this last round of home care negotiations led by Tony, over 700 of our members lost all of their coverage, whereas only 400 or 500 are now going to be covered under the current plan.
Do you hold Tony responsible for this?
I can't hold him directly responsible because the way that the union works is although they bring propositions to us, they have to be voted on by the membership. In the past, this membership has been led by what the staff recommends, and that's because they are more knowledgeable and have state lobbyists and things like that, and so we'll listen to them.
Sounds like how De'Anza Mobile Home Park was sold out at the last minute by its leaders when they had the opportunity to overturn the city council's destruction of rent control and then just let it go without turning in the signatures for the initiative.
Well, there's a lot of issues around money that we're constantly dealing with. I do know that, and looking at my information, that besides just the redevelopment agency will kick in the $30 million, but the hotel, that's for the shell of the conference center. The hotel owners will be kicking in the money for the internal components, and that'll include the kitchen and the administrative offices and the various things for the hotel. But they still have to retire the existing debt on the property. I don't know how much that is, but that has to be done before they can proceed on this current plan.
Who has to retire it?
The hotel owners must retire that debt.
So what's the significance of that?
I don't know because I don't know what the size of the debt is. I do know that that means that there's more financial things here than we're being privy to at the moment.
How close is this to being a done deal? I mean, we know that these seems like to me when the city council starts counseling evening sessions and then sets up special sessions the next week, one after another, one day after another, it looks to me like a fast track. And it looks to me like a fast track that is designed to some extent to exclude or sideline the public, though some would say, well, look, it's happening at the Civic Auditorium. They're letting in the public, and indeed perhaps for a very functional purpose, to have, as the caller is correct, to have beach boardwalk people who are paid supporters of this come rolling in to say, we want the center. So maybe it is, they are opening it up to the public. Is this a fast-track situation? Where's the deadline? When can we say we're doomed?
Well, for the union people, I can certainly speak for what we're going through. It does seem like a fast-track situation. There was members at the meeting of COPE, the Committee on Political Education, that expressed a lot of concern. Our bylaws are very specific that when there is an endorsement by the union, that membership must be notified and able to be present at those meetings. And in this particular case, the notice of the meeting went out about a week before the meeting. And we're very specific with that. It has to be at least enough time for the membership to come in and vote on that.
What's the usual time?
It's got to be at least 2 weeks before the meeting.
And so this was a violation of your bylaws?
Well, in essence, because the bylaws are written in a very general way that it also states that under special circumstances, this can be bypassed. I'm not sure in this case what the special circumstances are unless it is, as you said, a fast track. What we're hoping at this point is that notification will go out for the executive board meeting we're having the last Tuesday of the month. However, the city council will have already voted by then. So I'll be very interested to see if any representatives of SEIU show up to give an implied endorsement of this project before the actual membership gets to do its voting.
Huh. Now, you're here. It sounds like you oppose this project.
On a personal level, I oppose it, but the main reason I'm here is because of what I was just speaking about. I don't feel that the membership has been given enough notification and information in order to make an intelligent decision. We were handed an information packet when we arrived at the meeting, and we're supposed to vote on it within a very short time. The proponents of the program, Leslie Scanagata said she was representing the city chapter, although no city chapter members were in attendance. We did have the disembodied voice of a city member on the telephone, which was also in support. But in this case, again, it was definitely described as a profit-motivated project that would supply union jobs for the local people.
Is there, I'm always looking for ways of people who are trying to assert their rights, assert at least an opportunity for real public process and for the real interests of people to be able to be expressed. Is there? I mean, do you think there's a way that residents, it sounds like there's a number of interest groups here that are potentially opposed to this, or actually opposed to this. There's Clearview Court residents, there's West Side neighbor residents who live on that street, there's enlightened union reps. Although, what percentage of the union do you think actually does oppose it? I mean,
that's going to be hard to say. A lot of the people who belong to the union who are active in it are very oriented towards jobs and towards the benefits of what that's going to bring.
You're listening to Free Radio, and we are broadcasting, well, actually, we're on the net at www.freakradio.org, and we, I guess somebody is broadcasting us, or your radio wouldn't be hearing it at 101.1 FM, but actually, it's not coming out of here, so I don't know quite who's broadcasting us, but I can tell you, keep up the good work. In any case, in the studio with us, we have Liberty Lana and Penny Oliver of Clearview Court, and Tim Ahern of God knows where. SEIU 415, is that what we're talking?
415. Now, I do know the city enjoys what they consider to be a terrific credit rating. And one of the things that when you get a notification that you have a really good credit rating is that you really want to use that and you want to get some projects going to really, you know, pump that up. You always want to get your credit up. That's one of the great things about America is we have the opportunity to do that.
Well, just so we can all ponder our credit ratings, let's take a musical break here while we all check our pocketbooks and figure out where we're going to be when they oust us from our mobile homes or grates or wherever we happen to be.
You know, can't you see, this kind of loving will set you free, will set you free. Praise the Lord, praise the Lord, His love is gracious, His love is kind, His love is kind. Mountain meadow, lonely shoreline, crowded city, His love is kind, His love is kind. Don't you know, can't you see, His gifts are precious, won't you agree, won't you agree. I'm glad to be living, it's good to be free, His kind of loving's the way it should be, the way it should be. Praise the Lord, praise the Lord, this kind of loving will set you free, will set you free, will set you free, will set you free.
say you love me, then you say goodbye. Now I'm on this mountain, somewhere way up high. And you're in the city, somewhere down below. Wish I could hold you, like to let you know just how much I love you, and what you mean to me. Maybe I will see you somewhere by the sea.
Of Downtown Dave. Boy, he sounds a lot better than I thought he did. Dave, I got to take my hat off to you. That's some nice picking and strumming. A couple of things that just came in on the web here from Joe Williams. An article, I guess, from the Chronicle today. Sam Farr urges immediate action to begin withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. 16 House Democrats, led by Representative Lynn Woolsey of Petaluma, called on President Bush on Wednesday to begin the immediate removal of U.S. troops from Iraq, just as some administration supporters are starting to question the wisdom of staying the course in the war. So far, the Bush administration remains publicly unshakable in its position that the elections on January 30th should proceed, despite fears about safety for voters in parts of Iraq, and there's more about that. Farr's coming out against the war in Iraq is quite surprising. Had you heard about this, Tim?
Yes, I have.
And what's the word on that? What's
It's all good.
It's all
That's
good.
That's exactly what we're looking for.
Well, so what?
I belong to U.S. Labor Against the War, U.S. Law.
Right.
We recently had a conference in Chicago and came up with a number of strategies we're going to try and effect in the AFL-CIO against this war.
Well, interesting. Here it says the anti-war Democrats' letter was sent as more voices are being raised across the political spectrum in Washington discussing how the United States could begin to remove its 150,000 troops from a country where almost 1,400 Americans have been killed. Woolsey and other House Democrats, including Representative Sam Farr of Carmel, Pete Stark of Fremont, and Barbara Lee of Oakland, urged the administration to move swiftly. Quote, while it may be logistically difficult to immediately remove every American soldier, we urge you to take immediate action to begin the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. This is the only way to truly support our troops, said the letter signed by Woolsey and her colleagues. The House Democrats, all of them longtime critics of Bush's Iraq policies, said the U.S.-led invasion in March 2003 has stirred anti-American sentiments among Iraqis and other Arabs, made Iraqis and foreigners in the country less safe, and intensified the rage of extremist Muslim terrorists. By removing our troops from the country, we will remove the main focus of the insurgents' rage, the letter said. Woolsey spokeswoman Susanna Chernovich said only logistical factors prevented Woolsey from calling on Bush to immediately withdraw all the forces. If she had her way, they would all leave now, she said of Woolsey. What does Labor for Peace say about this?
Well, even when it was Mesopotamia, the British wouldn't mess with it. It is just an impossible area to hold, and at this rate, the resistance grows stronger and stronger, and it becomes a permanent war. There is absolutely no end in sight.
Continuing in the same article, which I was reading actually something about this a couple days ago, the AP reported that conservative Representative Howard Coble, Republican of North Carolina, who supported the decision to invade Iraq, also said last week it was time to start pondering a phased withdrawal in light of the American casualties in Iraq. I got fed up with picking up the paper and reading 12 to American soldiers killed, he was quoted as saying. How many will we lose tomorrow? I don't think anyone is seriously considering withdrawing at this juncture. I have. Coble added. The time has come for Iraqi people to assume more responsibility. But the idea of Democrats actually reflecting the anti-war opinion of their constituents, what a novelty.
There's a horrible psychological pressure that's put on people who have members of their family who are in the military and who are participating in this, that if somehow they're against this war, they're not supporting their family members. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite. Already the people who have come home from the war, I don't know how many homeless are already appearing on the streets from the Iraqi war, but the effects of it are huge. We're really hoping to hear from a lot of these folks, and the Central Labor Council is associated with the Speak Out, the Veterans Speak Out, and it's one of those cases where there are resources available for people to call if you want to help your loved ones to get out of the service and get out of this. We never hear reported how many people are in Canada right now who are resisting returning, or how many people outright refuse to go.
Yeah, actually, Joe Williams was talking about this a few days ago on the show. He's encouraging people to get draft counseling and to either become counselors themselves, or if you need to to assist those who are doing that. He's given a number, and I wish I had the number with me in the studio right now. Perhaps you have a number people can call?
I don't have one handy.
And I don't either. But if you got a number, call in here to 427-3772. Phone lines are open in the studio with Tim Ahern, Robert Norris, and Liberty Lana, as well as Penny Oliver of Clearview Court. We were talking before about the upcoming City Council wham, bam, thank you, ma'am deal that's coming, done deal that's going to be shoved through next week. But even in the face of that potential fait accompli or coup d'etat, you, Liberty, are circulating a petition. You want to talk a little bit about that petition? What does that petition say?
I don't know. I didn't really read it, but it's...
What? What have I got in the studio?
Well, I read it.
All right, your cover's blown. You're out of here.
Well,
Mike Rodkin, take the mic.
I know what he's saying. I know what he's saying. So oppose the
why don't you read it? Read the petition. It's good.
The proposed sign to the lads for this... I can read it. I'm nervous.
That's what you're doing. You're doing great. You're doing great. I'll read it for you. Petition against the current plan to reconstruct the Coast Hotel and construct a new conference center parking structure. We, the undersigned, are opposed to the current plan to reconstruct the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel and construct a new 1,200-person conference center and adjoining six-story parking facility funded with $30 million of city money. We are opposed to it, the project in its current form for the following reasons. One, the proposed design is too large for the site, is too massive in relation to nearby buildings, and is generally incompatible with the surrounding residential neighborhood. Two, the conference center and parking structure are too close to the Clearview Court community, devastating their quality of home life and right to sunshine. Three, the project will adversely affect the traffic and transportation in and around the beach area, the Bay Street corridor, and the entire west side of Santa Cruz. And four, the project does not conform to the local coastal plan or the city's general plan. And I don't know who this is being circulated by, but at least I know you're circulating it, right, Liberty?
Yeah, I'm circulated, and if you want to sign it, and you can either call me or come to my house, or I will go to your house, or I will meet you any place you want.
Are you looking for people to do some
to
table,
sign in?
To sign, looking for anybody to go out and say circulate these petitions? Suppose people want to go out and take them around.
Yeah, if they want to circulate it, they can call me, or I'm looking for people who can sign it, people who are against, and I can give you my phone number here in Santa Cruz.
Go for it.
It's 457-1261. You can call me, and like I say, anything I can do, go to your house, meet you on the street.
Will you pay $50 a signature? No, just kidding. But
No.
You have petitions available for people to take out and circulate themselves.
Yes, we have some, and I can.
Because I remember how De Anza, how there were just people out, you know, gathering signatures by the hundreds, by the thousands.
Uh-huh.
And of course, this is not that petition was a petition that required the city council to hold a referendum, and of course, Sterling Frost, to his eternal shame, did not. Talked his people at the Taylor Park out of turning in those mm-hmm. signatures. This has not got the force of law, but I guess you're hoping that if you present
many
signatures, you know, at this council meeting,
maybe they can listen.
You might import some sharpshooters from Iraq, or possibly some suicide bombers. Just kidding, folks. Another little light humor here as the evening wears on. You also, Penny, I guess the two of you had something to announce regarding. A meeting coming up with the distinguished Ryan Coonerty, one of our new council members.
Yeah, before you go into that, I'd like to say to the people, if you don't want to call me and you like to come to Clearview Court, my house number is 32, so you are welcome to sign this petition in my house. And now I pass it to Penny.
Hey, are you going to be providing refreshments? All right, well, maybe coffee. Go ahead. Penny.
Ryan Coonerty is coming at 3 o'clock on Saturday, this coming Saturday, to discuss the convention center and its impact upon Clearview Court, etc. And anybody interested is welcome to come also.
At 170 West Cliff Drive?
Yes.
And is there a particular building at Clearview?
Be outside.
Okay. And so that's this Saturday? Or this
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock this Saturday. And, how can people get more information about this? Can they call you, Liberty?
They can call me.
457-1261. Again, Liberty, if you want to sign the petition, which is calling for, it's against the current plan to reconstruct the Coast Hotel and construct the new conference center.
And really, I like to encourage all my neighbors, because this is important. We know that we fight for long, many, many months to keep a rent control. And I know everybody's tired about this, but please, this is important. It's important for your children. And it's important for people who get old. And we are going to have all the fumes into Clearview Court because they feel the city council members and the other people that we are nobody. So we need to go and talk to them, especially in these two very important meetings that are coming. I know we are tired. I'm tired because we fought for 8 months or 9 months. Anita's tired. Jim is tired. Everybody's tired, but we need to do it. So please come to all these meetings. It's very important.
Tim, are you going to get the union folks to come down to Liberty's and sign? You're going to take a petition around for union people to sign?
Yes, I will be talking to union people and encouraging them to come down as well as to attend the meetings and to call into the office and to find out when they can come to our executive board meeting and discuss the issue openly before an official endorsement is made.
And, of course, if members want to, there is no petition currently at the Huff table, though there are people listening to this broadcast, hopefully downtown on Pacific Avenue. If you want to get information about this, I'm going to try to get a copy of this petition from Liberty in the days ahead. I think she only has one with her, and that's going to Tim, but we can make copies and have it available. Unfortunately, the next Huff table is next Wednesday, which is just about the time that the city council will be ramming it down our throats. But, if you see me in my multicolored vehicle with many a bumper sticker wandering around town, just ask and I will, if Liberty's got those petitions to me by that time, and perhaps you can, Liberty, I'll pass it on for people to sign. You might leave the petition, for example, at places like Alfresco's downtown, like a little kiosk in front of the New Leaf Market. She's quite sympathetic with that. You know, and might leave it at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. They might be sympathetic. I know, if you may remember, Doug Rand in the old days, he opposed this conference center and this, you know. Kennedy is there, but he does not run the Resource Center. There are other people there. We have a caller. Let's see perhaps some suggestions. Hi, you're on Free Radio with the Big Four here.
Hey, Robert, it's Scott again.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Haven't you talked enough?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Scott.
Anyway, to get back to this meeting with Rockin, he was also saying, well, if this project seems to be something that, you know, is going to be affect Clearview Court in a negative way, then maybe it won't get built either. He didn't say it wouldn't. He said maybe it won't get built. You know, he said, but, you know, there's other options on things to do with Clearview Court. And so I took that as meaning that, you know, this whole idea, this rumor that had been circulating around earlier that Barry Swinson wants to get in on this hotel deal. And so he would probably be willing to move all the trailers in Clearview Court down to the end of Delaware Street where the homeless garden now sits, because that's Swenson family land that the homeless garden is sitting on. And, I mean, myself, I see that as a real possibility. I mean, they're not the hotel developers, the city, nobody wants those trailers there, you know. It's the people that have the trailers there want the trailers there, and they're about the only ones. And so it's, to me, I take it as that something's up with that whole scenario.
We were talking about Barry Swinson a little earlier in the show. Tim, you had some, and you and Liberty both had comments about Barry and his sort of involvement in the past with Clearview Court and also with other projects in Santa Cruz. Yeah, he is the owner of Clearview Court, right?
He is the owner of Clearview Court. So far as we know, he's the owner.
Right.
Right, he is.
And so he, what kind of role has he had in this situation, Penny?
It's C.L. Swinson and some other Swensons, but it's all under the umbrella of the Barry Swinson Company, and the Barry Swinson Company is the group that's managing the mobile home park.
Uh-huh. What is his role been in the past? I mean, how long have the two of you lived at Clearview? How long, Penny, how long have you lived there?
Since 99 and Liberty since 98.
So what's been the history? Swenson's just recently acquired the property, right?
Well, it's been a few years. They mostly don't do anything except support the elimination of rent control. And there's 13 residents that have expressed interest in selling their property. And the Swensons want to buy it, they say, but they won't tell us when, and they won't tell us how much, and they won't move on it. They just keep saying, we'll get back to you in a couple of weeks.
As the property prices drop.
I don't know. But my request was made to them in October. Antonio's was made in November. And other people all the way through the fall months, the summer months, and there's still no word from them.
Interesting. Any comment on this, Liberty?
No, really. The only thing everybody in Clearview Court is very concerned because is nothing being done in there. They
no
are quite nothing. And they have the green light to go and build the $9 million townhouses.
So
I think it's nine.
So why aren't they building is the question. Huh?
They are not doing anything.
Because they intend instead to simply gut the property, sell it, and move on.
We are very concerned because one of the mobile homes moved out from there before the end of our rent control battle, and they didn't put anything in there. It's still empty. So if you feel that those people...
That happened in February 2004.
Yeah, if those people, they want our money to run this place, they are not doing anything.
Tim, any comments on this?
It sounds very much like that's exactly what they plan to do. Is just that it's very typical for them not to do any improvements if they're just going to sell the land or do something. Barry Swenson's record, in terms of what I'm familiar with, they were awarded a very large amount of building contracts in San Jose and Santa Clara, and the understanding was when they were awarded these large contracts that a certain amount of low-income housing would be built, and those that's never been honored. As far as my information goes, that company has never built the homes, the low-income housing, and affordable housing that they did promise to build, but continues to do business in the area and continues to do business specifically with governments, with city governments and the state.
And liberals and progressive socialist feminists.
Very
like
progressive.
Mike Rotkin.
Well, the other thing they...
Any comments from you, Scott, caller?
The other thing that Swenson's famous for is sidestepping the whole union issue. Whenever he does work for city governments, county governments, or for the state of California, because he's been involved in a number of UCSC and San Jose State projects, he's supposed to have what they call prevailing wage, which means the wage that the unions pay their workers. Every project that Swenson has ever built, whether it's here or over the hill, has been protested by the unions because he doesn't do that.
Is this slanderous commentary on Barry Swenson possibly true? Tim, refute it if you can.
I cannot.
What other slanders do you have for us, caller, against Barry Swenson?
Well, like I said, I really think that Swenson's prime objective with buying Clearview Court has been and still is to become a partner in this whole hotel conference center deal. Because, that land would add to this project. They could make the project bigger. You know, there's a whole array of things that could happen. And if there's a giant parking structure on the current parking lot, the condos that he already has permission to build aren't going to be worth as much if they're right next door to a six-story parking structure. So it would behoove him just to become a partner with the hotel owners in this whole project and, add his land to theirs.
But surely, didn't Barry come before the city council and assure them that there was no possible connection going on here when the rent control was gutted and Swenson made his deal with the city council?
I don't know if Barry ever actually went up and talked to him, did he?
Well, I know he had some
representatives talk to him.
He had Jeff Daniels there. Yeah, I don't think
he ever talked
Jeff
to him.
Major, sorry.
The city council is too meaningless for him to go talk to personally.
Hmm.
You know, it's like, he's Barry Swenson.
Yeah, right. Well, you've got to know who to talk to around here. Anything else, caller? Any commentary or questions, interaction? Any questions?
Well, the other thing that I wanted to say was that last night there was a Transportation Commission meeting about the hotel.
Yeah, we already mentioned that they voted it down.
Yeah, they voted
61?
It down, and the Planning Commission voted in favor of it a couple of weeks ago, and their whole reason for voting in favor of it was because of the economic stimulus, and that's not part of what the Planning Commission is even supposed to look at. The economics of a project is not within the Planning Commission's preview or purview.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose to vote in favor of something for reasons that they're not even supposed to ponder.
Well, it's the wild and crazy planning commissions, you know, right. Getting into the. I mean, this is Santa Cruz. They're weird. Come on.
Yeah, and then tonight at that meeting with Rockin, most of the people that spoke kept on saying, you know, we got to slow this process down. There hasn't been enough public input into the whole process. Da 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 da. And so, what I said to Rockin was, you know, that all these people saying to slow this down, have more public input. Just shows once again that the redevelopment agency needs to have a commission, because these projects, or to use Seal Cirillo's own terms, development schemes, come to the council, who sit as the redevelopment agency, already put together. It's not like they tell Seal, oh, go put this together. She put something together, her and her staff, bring it to the council basically as a done deal, and they rubber stamp it. And so, you know, if there was a commission that oversaw redevelopment, that would be one more avenue for the public to put input into a project at its very beginnings, instead of at the end when it's already a done deal. And all it's waiting for is a rubber stamp.
But you don't want to muddy up the whole situation, caller, with public discussion. I mean, don't you want to leave this to the experts?
Well, there was another point I want to make, which is not really to do with this issue, but has to do with public input, was that there was recently a lawsuit that was won in Los Angeles where somebody sued the city council because people were not paying attention during the public hearing.
They were doing the Kennedy paper shuffle.
Right. They were talking to each other, wandering around, laughing and rolling their eyes and stuff like that. The council here does that constantly.
So it may be time to do
another
lawsuit.
And so now that there's a precedent, you know, it's time for somebody to slap these guys up against the side of the head with a lawsuit saying you got to pay attention.
I'll back you up, Scott. Go for it.
Okay.
Hey, I guess, I had something I was going to ask you, but it slipped my mind. Any other questions for Scott, who's a council watcher for a long time? I call him an Scope It Out Scott when I write a little blurbs in the street shit sheet, an occasional newsletter. Any questions for Scott? Comments? Any you wish to denounce him before he leaves? Scott.
Great job, Scott.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, Robert, I guess I'll...
And I want to thank you, Scott. Thank you very much for your help.
Maybe you'd like to circulate a petition if Liberty can get you one, Scott.
Well, I don't know if she's circulating the same petition that this group Scrap is, Santa Cruz for Responsible Planning.
Is Scrap's name on their petition?
I don't think so.
Because this is a petition. It's a box format, lined, has four different concerns.
I think it's the same petition.
Same petition. Okay. So that's good. Maybe Scott,
they're supposed to be getting some flyers together by this weekend, so people can hand them up downtown or hand them out, you know.
Maybe you can give
in neighborhoods and stuff.
Scott,
like
maybe
that.
You could give Scrap a call and ask them to either call into this show, which has another half hour remaining, or to contact the show on Sunday from 9:30 to 1 when we return with a long stretch of time.
Yeah, Ralph Myberg is one of their spokespersons, so maybe you could get him to talk.
If I knew his phone number, I might, but I don't. So why don't you give him a call and ask him to call in?
Okay, I'll see if I can find his number.
Appreciate that.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, phone lines are open for all you supporters of the Coast Hotel Project. Mike Rotkin, where are you when we want you? Give us a call, Mayor Mike. This is Free Radio, freakradio.org, also 101.1 FM. You can give us a call at 427-3772. What about Tony Madrigal? I know that there's some Huff members meeting with that council member this weekend to talk to him about the sleeping ban, which is, of course, a law that criminalizes homeless people outside in a city that has place for only 5% of the homeless people each night.
I believe he said he would look at that issue.
He would certainly, probably will look at it as he drives by.
In his campaign, he said that he would definitely examine
it.
Yes,
he did. And when I brought it up right after he was crowned, it looks like Liberty and Penny are heading out. You want to say goodbye? Say goodbye to your fans before.
Yeah. Goodbye. Good night to everybody. And remember that we, the ones who are against and we are against, we have to fight this. We need more time. That's what we ask the city council members. We need more time. Not the end. You start the beginning talking to people. We are in democracy. I came to this country because that, but it's not happening in Santa Cruz so far as I know.
Penny?
She said it pretty well.
Okay, and remember,
show up on Wednesday, especially.
Show up on Saturday when Ryan Coonerty at 3 o'clock comes to Clearview Court, when the public will be welcome, right? You aren't going to have the public excluded like they did from De Anza when this happened. That's what happened. De Anza tried to have a final vote, and they actually cut everybody out of that discussion. Well, even any kind of discussion was going on. All right, thanks. Thanks, Penny. I appreciate your throwing some light on this. Thanks, Liberty.
I think these women really embody the spirit of what's going on with the rank-and-file people of the world. They're folks that are waking up to the importance of participating in not only the government, but in what's going on locally in your cities and towns. Every person who lives on the west side should be looking at this. Having lived in Columbia and Pelt and having to commute in and out of that area, I know what the traffic is like at the T, right there at the corner of Bay and Westcliff, and also up at Bay and Mission. There is absolutely no way to escape that neighborhood without going through those areas. And in this case, the traffic study that's been done, the traffic, they were said that it would be minimalized, providing that the hotel ponied up its share of the money needed to make the necessary improvements to the roadways to get the traffic flowing. I'm not sure whether or not the hotel people are in for that kind of expenditure to improve the roads of Santa Cruz.
I have my doubts, too. And again, my knowledge, of course, on this issue, I shouldn't say I have my doubts. I'm ignorant on the issue. And I'm glad we got some folks here in the studio to talk about it. Again, my primary interest, again, is the destruction of low-income housing and the bad process that's going on. You know, a lot of homeless people may be saying, who in the hell cares if a bunch of, you know, West Side people have more traffic as they, you know, send out their cops to harass poor people? What difference does it make? Tim, your response to that would be?
Politics as usual.
Yeah, I mean, why jump on the bandwagon and try to defend the comfortable transportation situation for some West Side folks who are concerned about, you know, their neighborhoods getting, trafficked out when they are going after homeless people who are parked in vehicles because they have no other housing out along Mission Street Extension and in Harvey West and downtown? What's the percentage in that? Why should we be concerned?
Well, there's people I know in the home care business or the home care chapter who take great pains in giving their clients excellent care in their homes, and they're homeless. They're living out of their cars and showing up for work every day. Sometimes the clients that they serve are just helping out the actual workers. I mean, I don't want to go as far as to say that there's any improprieties going on in terms of maybe allowing someone to take a shower in your home or anything like that.
Come on
but
now.
We certainly do have a portion of our workforce that is homeless. And when we look at the overall figures for the country, and we've got 12, 13 million people who work every single day but still live in poverty.
Right, of course, you know, I can't disagree with you, but why should any of us who are concerned about those issues be concerned about this issue with the Coast Hotel?
Well, this is just another example of big money and big business moving forward issues and not taking into account humanity and the people. Santa Cruz is an amazing area. It has a wonderful opportunity to become a self-sufficient and self-supporting example of how we're going to do things in the future. The way that we utilize energy in this country, the kind of ecological footprint that we leave on the planet is just gigantic. We are using up resources at a phenomenal rate. We would need approximately 4 planets in order to support everyone on this earth if they consumed at the rate that we consume. So we've got an opportunity as well. I don't know if you're into the peak oil theory, the bell curve that indicates that we have reached that point of peak oil, but that's going to significantly change the way that energy is supplied to areas like this. There are several pieces that are available on it, but essentially the large company and the large corporation has an infrastructure that replaces the small business and the small distribution network. In cases around here, we have an incredible number, I think the largest number of organic farmers in any area, and we have a terrific opportunity to feed ourselves. If we look at all the lawn and garden that is maintained by the city, and excuse me, all the lawns that are maintained by the city and then could turn them into gardens, we certainly would have quite a bit of food. But essentially the theory is that once these larger companies come forth and subvert this local infrastructure, when the energy and the larger systems fail, we are left on a local level with nothing. And so we have an opportunity here in our area to create an economy of this nature, to create a independent power sources, to create independent food sources, to create a situation where we are essentially self-supporting in many, many ways. And to look at a project like this in just a frame of dollars and cents makes no sense. It's again the idea that profitability is only about money, and this is where our government is today.
Well, a question is, where are you listeners today? If you want, you can call in today, tonight, this minute even, at 427-3772. Around the Iraqi situation, I'm quite surprised that, and please, because long overdue, one wonders why suddenly this thunderclap from far, and I don't know, couple dozen other congressional Democrats. I guess they're still not calling for immediate withdrawal. They're still talking about a schedule for withdrawal.
Well,
in 6 months. This is sort of the position Nader took a year ago or something.
Well, we still have to get through the coronation.
January 20th. Now, you've got some stuff planned on the 20th. You want to talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. There's some fantastic coalitions forming together. U.S. Labor Against the War, the Labor for Peace group are joining in with WILF, the Peace Coalition. I wish I had all of my paperwork here to tell you about it, but there's a fantastic event which is very strong for taking responsibility for our government on the 20th. It is also not one damn dime day, and we are advocating no one spend any money on that day. But locally, we're looking at an event that's going to start out at the county building about 4:30, and it's going to include a voter bill of rights that'll be read, some music by some terrific local artists. There will be a few speakers, and then we are going to inaugurate the people. It is a procedure. It's the same ceremony that where you take the oath of office and essentially will defend the Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights. Taking responsibility, it's not just turning out to vote. It's really taking responsibility for what happens with the government. That inauguration of the people will be followed by a march down to the collateral damage structure where there will be some more music, and I believe we have confirmation I got this afternoon that George McGovern will be addressing the crowd. He's appearing at the Vet Center as part of a UCSC education, but he will be addressing the crowd for a short time that evening.
Promise Mike Rotkin will not be there?
I cannot promise that. What I'm hoping is that everybody will be there. What I'm hoping is that this will cross the lines of partisanship and really create a unity.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that the city council probably to a woman agrees with probably getting out of Iraq, although Porter apparently has been doing a soft shoe on the Vets for Peace stuff. Have you been following any of that?
Somewhat. The Vets for Peace and some terrific people in town. Francis, if you're out there, you know, kudos. You're doing an amazing job on that resolution. Have proposed a resolution to the city council. Not only this city council, but much the same as it was proposed initially several years ago, the cities that followed are being encouraged to do the same in kind and to go ahead and follow this resolution to get our troops out of Iraq.
I actually have a report on that, which I think I'm not going to be able to play tonight, but it was from Roger, et cetera, who's a tireless street worker who's been doing a lot of work with the Vets. He's homeless, but he's one of the most articulate people I know, and one of the he's faster than Mike Rotkin with his mouth. I can tell you that. Roger, nothing escapes him. If you're interested in these issues, you can also do some petition signing. Huff has five different petitions that's circulating. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We have a table we share with Copwatch, which is down in front of Borders Bookstore every Thursday evening tonight. From 6 to 8, we play the show on the table on the radio. You can hear it. You can sign the petitions urging the council to follow Representative Farr's lead. I mean, if Farr is going to do it, certainly Rotkin can't be far behind. That's not quite a pun, but, you know, you get my drift. Of course, the other petitions are going to be a little harder for the city council to act on. Well, we've urged the impeachment of Bush, not just for the committee to investigate the impeachment of Bush, but impeachment of Bush. The man has declared illegal aggressive war. He's been killing civilians. He's initiated an occupation that costs, what is it? Is it 9 million? It's 9 million an hour.
An hour, right.
And I think it's about 5 or 6 billion a month, maybe more. I keep getting different figures on that.
There's some great information on what $150 billion will buy circulating out on the web if people are interested. And there's also a website called nationalpriorities.com, which will allow you to investigate our area and any area of the country and how it's affected by financially by the war.
I also kind of like to do these gloomy updates, although tonight it's not so gloomy with, you know, at least some Democrats beginning to start talking about eventually getting, I guess everybody's talking about eventually getting out. But, of course, this latest fig leaf, the election coming up on the 20th in Iraq, which is falling apart completely. Here's a report from Juan Cole, who has a website on the Internet. Falling like flies, 53 Iraqi parties withdraw from elections. Elections, I think, are still going on. According to the Al Farat newspaper, 53 political parties and organizations, as well as 30 individuals, have asked their names to be dropped from the election lists in Iraq as in a bid to show their rejection of elections under U.S. occupation. There had been 105 parties and individuals and six coalitions participating in the elections. So that's 53 parties and 30 individuals. That's more than half leaving. There were only 30 individuals running as independents, and it appears now they have all withdrawn, and half of the registered parties have also withdrawn, if Al-Farad is correct. The individuals mostly never had a chance, since voters get only one vote, and few would have wasted it on a single individual when they could vote for an entire party list. So their withdrawal may in part simply reflect a realistic assessment of their chances, but parties at least had the potential of gaining a seat or a few seats, and their withdrawals are serious. The same news service says that among those withdrawing is the Patriotic Front for Iraqi Tribes, a Sunni Arab party. The party, which groups 40 major tribes, said that the security situation had to improve before elections could be held. Zinhunat said that it was also protesting the arrest of Sheikh Hassan Zadan Khalaf al-Lahibi last week. He plays a role in uniting the tribes and has his own party. Al-Sharik al-Aswat says that as well, Sheikh Hassan's own party, the National Front for Iraqi Unity, has withdrawn from the election to protest his recent arrest. This party is number 101 on the list given here Wednesday of slates. There's a lot of specifics on this website, which it sounds perhaps there's unfamiliar Arabic names here, but we're talking about an individual who keeps pretty close tabs on what's going on in Iraq, it sounds like, and actually is himself did not favor withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. I don't think he does favor withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. So what he has to say about the withdrawal of people from this election is all the more interesting in being what we call reluctant testimony. That is, say, testimony from a person who's if he supports a different view, it would seem to be he's saying so reluctantly, hence there may have more truth to it. Minister of State Adnan Janabi, a key aide of interim prime minister and unelected minister Iyad Alawi, prime minister, has resigned to protest being detained and handcuffed by U.S. troops at a checkpoint outside the Green Zone where government offices and the U.S. embassy are barricaded. It was revealed last week that Janabi was giving envelopes with $100 in them to journalists who covered the press conferences of the Iraqi National Court, a party mainly made up of ex-Baathists that probably has little popularity in Iraq. Wire services report 11 dead in Iraq violence, including two car bombings and a gun battle in Mosul, the assassination of the deputy police chief of Bakuba, the burning of four bank guards, and the shooting of a policeman in Baghdad. It sort of almost sounds repetitious to keep running through this stuff.
It's never ending. It's not going to end.
It's...
U.S. Labor Against the War has been working with some of the Iraqi trade unions that have formed. These are people that are unfortunately in a position, and this is some of the debate that's going on within the organization, they're in a position where they must work with the U.S. occupying forces in order to maintain any kind of structure to manufacture and to do their union work. There was some dissension about whether we should be supporting these unions or not, but the truth is they're absolutely working for the rights of people and the rights of workers to do their jobs and to have a quality of life.
Aren't unions still illegal in Iraq? That was my understanding.
They are representing a large number of workers, and although they may have been illegal under the Saddam Hussein or Baathist regime, the United States is allowing and working with these folks. This is part of the problem. They are allowing it only because the unions are, I hesitate to say, but kowtowing, but they are definitely responding to the pressure that's being put on them by the government.
I'm going to have to do a little research here because I would swear I was reading an article about restrictions on unions, significant restrictions on unions.
Very possible.
Still under the Alawi regime. Here's an article from The Guardian. This election could plunge Iraq further into the abyss. Rigged polls held under foreign occupation have a notorious pedigree by Sumas Milne, Thursday, January 13th, today, The Guardian. They are routinely described by the BBC as Iraq's first free and democratic election, sometimes for half a century, sometimes in the country's history. During his lightning stopover in Baghdad last month, British Prime Minister Tony Blair insisted that whatever you had thought of the war, no one could now avoid taking sides in what had become a simple battle between democracy and terror in Iraq. And even if enthusiasm for the election scheduled for January 30th is usually tempered by an admission that they are bound in practice to prove imperfect, there is a widespread view in the occupying countries that they offer the best chance to begin to lift the country out of its current misery. We have, of course, been here before. Every landmark since the U.S. and British invasion nearly 2 years ago has been claimed as a turning point for the occupation, the moment when support for the resistance would start to recede and a new showcase Iraq emerge from the blood-drenched devastation. And no doubt for those who thought Iraqis would welcome their invaders with flowers, that they wouldn't resist foreign occupation, that Saddam Hussein's capture would take the wind out of the fighters' sails, that last June's handover of sovereignty would be seen as genuine, with the punitive destruction of Fallujah would break the back of the insurgency. For them, this month's planned ballot will surely seem to be the crucial event that must, at last, deliver legitimacy to the puppet regime holed up in Baghdad's infamous Green Zone. But, in reality, the elections are likely at best to be irrelevant, at worst to plunge Iraq deeper into the abyss. Both common sense and first principles dictate that no election in a country invaded and controlled by foreign troops can conceivably be regarded as free and fair. The poll due on January 30th is part of a process imposed by Bush's pro-counsel, Paul Bremer, transparently designed to entrench U.S. plans for Iraq and the wider Middle East. All the main politicians and parties taking part owe their position and physical survival to U.S. protection and power, and voting will take place in a country under martial law, where a full-scale guerrilla war is raging and whose heartlands are under daily bombardment. Fallujah, a city of 350,000 people, has been razed to the ground in the past couple of months, and its people expelled to refugee camps, where they have less chance to vote, even if they wanted to, than Iraqi refugees living in Britain. The U.S.-appointed government has cracked down on the recalcitrant press and expelled the independent Al Jazeera TV station, while the hands of any future administration have been tied by a U.S.-imposed neoliberal economic program that essentially gave away all the resources of Iraq. Add to that the fact that major political groups and politicians are boycotting the elections, including the popular Shia leader Muqtada al-Sadr, as illegitimate under occupation, while security is so bad in four of the country's provinces, accounting for more than half the population. You often hear it's only 4 out of 18 provinces. Apparently it's half the population, if this is accurate, that both the U.S. Ground Forces commander and U.S.-installed Prime Minister Ayad Alawi said this week it would be too dangerous for many people to vote. And just as intimidation is expected to enforce a boycott in some Sunni-dominated areas, pro-regime militias are expected to dragoon Shia voters to the polls in parts of the South. Without election observers, the scope for fraud is clearly extensive. Most candidates' names on party lists have been withheld, giving new meaning to the term secret ballot. While voter registration forms are being widely traded for dollars. But, most crucially of all, whatever the turnout and relative votes for the different lists, the result cannot and will not reflect the popular will over the most important issue facing the country, the occupation. Opinion polls show most Iraqis want foreign troops to leave now. But none of those with a chance of being elected, all compromised by their links to the current administration, supports such a demand. Without foreign troops, they would fear for their own skins. None of this should come as much of a shock. We are familiar with managed elections the world over, and phony polls under foreign occupation have a long pedigree. Take the U.S. client regime in South Vietnam, where fraudulent but contested elections were held from the 1950s to the 1970s, including at the height of the American War. Just as in Iraq, newspapers were suppressed and parties staged boycotts or were banned, while polling was often suspended in Viet Cong-controlled areas, or alternatively, the government won a miraculously high vote. Then there were Iraq's own rigged elections under the British-installed regime before 1958. As in Iraq today, thousands of prisoners were held without trial, newspapers and parties were banned, and torture was rampant. The credibility of Iraq's January 30th poll is so flagrantly in doubt, it is no wonder that there is pressure both from within the U.S. administration and prominent Iraqi politicians for a postponement. The danger is that the election won't simply lack credibility, but could intensify Iraq's crisis by fueling sectarian divisions. The combination of the effective truce with Sadr's Mahdi army, while the U.S. military concentrates its fire on the Sunni-based resistance, lack of Shia support for Fallujans during November's onslaught, and the commitment to the elections by the governing Shia parties has strained relations to the limit. There are increasing fears among Iraqis that the U.S. is deliberately fostering sectarian tension to divide and rule, or even open the way to the de facto partition of the country. When the New York Times' Thomas Friedman argues that we have to have a proper election in Iraq so we can have a proper civil war, and Charles Krautheimer suggests in the Washington Post that we should see Iraqi factionalism as a useful tool, it's hardly surprising such ideas flourish. The U.S.-British occupation has failed to deliver Iraqis' most basic needs and security, let alone their freedom. The resistance, dismissed as dead-enders and remnants after the fall of the Saddam regime, has mushroomed to the point where Iraqi intelligence puts it at 200,000 strong. A senior U.S. military officer has told Newsweek, "We are losing, and the Pentagon is reaching into the sewer of its history for the Salvador option, the use of local paramilitary death squads to wage a dirty war against the guerrillas." Britain's small band of occupation cheerleaders, who comprehensively lost
lost the argument about the war are now taking refuge in a self-righteous denunciations of the Iraqi resistance, the very forces that helped bring into being, they helped bring into being by supporting the unprovoked invasion of an independent state. They would do better to remind their friends that there can be no democracy without genuine sovereignty and self-determination. The only way to hold free and fair elections in Iraq and draw the sting of mass resistance is for the aggressor states to withdraw their forces and let the Iraqis run their own affairs. That's from Sumas Milne in The Guardian. Rigged, this election could plunge Iraq further into the abyss. Any comments, Ken?
Well, in the death squads, we realize it's not just going to be targeting the guerrillas themselves, but families, people. Traditionally, union people have always been targeted. Union leaders and activists have always been targeted by these. And if you'll look at who's running the country and what they used to do, I think you'll see that the death squad connection is pretty obvious. And then when we listen to reports that come out of Iraq, we get this picture that people are walking around, talking to people, looking at the scenario, you know, observing battles and things like that. And that's absolutely not correct. I mean, the reporters are embedded, all right. They're embedded in their hotel rooms, and they stand out on the balcony to show their panoramic view of where they're at, and give their reports, and then return to their hotel rooms. They are absolutely not on the ground, absolutely not experiencing what's going on in terms of the real people's plight.
Yeah. Well, we're running at almost at the very end of the show here. Last chance to get in a call. I'm going to read you a little something I read today from Cannabis Culture, issue 52. That's a kind of the what High Times should be. Magazine supporting decriminalization of drugs and opposing the drug war, opposing the drug prohibition. And what interested me, I'm going to read this article. It's called Prison State Blues. It's from the editor. As I write this editorial, many of my friends and loved ones in the cannabis community are in jail or facing the likelihood of going there. This is Canada, folks. Oh, Tim has taken off. Thanks, Tim. That was Tim Ahern with us tonight. Mark Emery, publisher of this fine
IHSS.
All right. Mark Emery, publisher of this fine magazine, founder of the BC Marijuana Party, and my friend for over a decade, is currently serving a 92-day sentence for passing a single joint in Saskatoon, Canada. Loretta Nall, Pot TV anchor and president of the U.S. Marijuana Party, is appealing her conviction for possession of 0.87 grams of pot seized during a 2002 raid on her home. And Renee Boige, a sweet and gentle woman who is clearly no harm to anyone, is awaiting a decision on her fate from Canada's justice minister. Boige is currently living in Vancouver with her Canadian husband, Chris Bennett, Pot TV station manager, and their two-year-old Canadian-born son, Shiva. Boige is fighting the U.S. government's efforts to extradite her to an American federal prison where she faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years to life, solely for her minor involvement with a state-approved medical cannabis garden. A decision in her case is expected early next year, and it seems likely that Canada will buckle to U.S. pressure and send her back to the U.S. There's a lot more in this editorial by the publisher in this issue of Cannabis Culture, but the point is that people working on this magazine are going to jail. There's actually a previous article by the publisher who actually writes from jail. What he writes is, I was kept in jail for 3 days and had to agree to outrageous bail conditions to get out of the clutches of Canada's original prohibition city. He went on a 22-city university and college tour to promote Jack Layton and the NDP policy of legally distributing marijuana. That's one of the four political parties up in Canada, culminating with my arrest in Saskatoon on April 22nd for passing a joint to a student in a local park after my speech. The point is not that he was arrested and jailed, but that he is continuing to write about it while he is in jail. He's continuing to publish a magazine, that the main people involved with this magazine seem to be in jail. That is to say, they're standing up for their principles in a way that people in Santa Cruz, myself included, don't seem to be doing. I'm not saying that jail is a wonderful place to be. I'm not saying it's even every time worth taking the risk of going to jail. But what are we all waiting for here in terms of the war in Iraq, in terms of the drug prohibition war? Better times? A better candidate from the Democratic Party? Perhaps an enlightened statement from the local Green Party, which still fails to censor Tim Fitzmaurice, the city council member who supports the anti-homeless laws. I don't know what we're waiting for. Maybe you can tell me next time on Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm going to leave a little early, put on a little downtown Dave, so when Uncle Dennis comes into the studio, I'll have a freer rein. Thanks for being with me on this edition, and I hope to see you on Sunday at 9:30. In the meantime, don't forget that next Thursday, as well as there being this counter-inaugural event, this Inaugurate the People event that Tim was talking about, there's going to be a meeting at the Homeless Services Center with the sleeping ban lawsuit on the agenda. The Homeless Service Center is the supposed protectors and supporters of homeless people that offer 160 floor spaces every night for homeless people, but don't come out publicly against the sleeping ban. We're going to try to get them to do that. That's going to be at 5:30 at the Homeless Services Center a week from today. See you there.
Don't you know? Can't you see? It's kind of loving. We'll set you free. We'll set you free. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. His love is gracious. His love is kind. His love is kind. Mountain meadow. Lonely shoreline, crowded city, His love is kind, His love is kind. Don't you know, can't you see, His gifts are precious, won't you agree? You agree? I'm glad to be living. It's good to be free. It's kind of loving the way it should be. The way it should be. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Kind of loving will set you free, will set you free, will set you free, will set you free.
you say goodbye. Now I'm on this mountain, somewhere way up high. And you're in the city, somewhere down below. Wish I could hold you, like to let you know. Just how much I love you, and what you mean to me. Maybe I will see you somewhere by the sea. First you say you love me, then you say goodbye. Now I'm on this mountain, somewhere way up high. And you are in the city, somewhere down below. Wish I could hold you, like to let you know. Just how much I love you, and what you mean to me. Maybe I will see you somewhere by the sea.